Today's episode of How Did I Get Here is brought to you by Feline, a chic boutique stocked with unique yet reasonably priced attire at 2110 South Lamar, Suite E, right here in Austin, Texas. I'm here with the owner, Emily. Emily, what will we find at Feline?
You'll find casual basics, handmade deerskin bags, elegant party dresses, eye-catching jewelry.
And an excellent record selection
with
vinyl.
Yes.
And why will people love it?
I guess adding to the atmosphere, I'm always on hand to help you find your best look. I do alterations as needed, and I won't lie to you until you look good if you don't.
That is Feline, located at 2110 South Lamar, Suite E. Austin Monthly Magazine says, squeezed between a dive bar and a barber shop on busy South Lamar, Feline combines elegance with cool. Is that right?
Yep.
And what are your hours? You open 5 days a week, 3 days a week?
I'm open 7 days a week, Tuesday through Saturday from 11 to 7. Sometimes I'm there a little bit later. And then Sundays and Mondays, I'm there from noon to 5.
Excellent. So be sure you do your shopping at Feline. Black Friday is coming up. Do you guys have any special sales?
We'll be doing 10% off anything in the store all day long. And I always have a little sale special for people that like the Facebook page.
That's Feline, 2110 South Lamar. Let me ask you just this one last question before they go. Do listeners, if they come in and say they got their information about Feline on How Did I Get Here, do you give them a discount?
Absolutely not.
No. Okay. Well, that's Feline, 2110 South Lamar, Suite E. Go buy your girlfriend some stuff there, or if you're a girl, go buy yourself there, or buy yourself something there. If you're a girl that has a girlfriend, buy your girlfriend something there. Let's get down.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time for How Did I Get Here?
Crazy Halloween weekend. I played in Houston on the roof of their baseball stadium with Skyrocket on Friday. That was a great gig. I need to still trying to figure out how to do the Skyrocket interview. I think it should be done in a series over time in hotel rooms and traveling and backstage and such. So I'm gonna work on that and put it together and hopefully. In a few weeks, I'll have a Skyrocket episode where we're all kind of talking, but in interesting doses. It's hard to do people you're real good friends with because, you know, we're together a lot. So, it's kind of tough to go in and ask. I haven't really had Liars and Saints. I had a very first podcast that I tried to do that I actually ended up deleting because I wasn't good at all. I didn't have the right feel or the right tone, and I was very aggressive. Was with Jeremy Nail, and it was just weird because we're in a band together and we do a lot of stuff together. So that's just odd. So anyway, so I'm going to figure out how to do that. Anyway, so then Saturday night we played this costume party. It's an Easter Seals kind of party, and people were dressed elaborately, like with these giant, you know, incredible costumes. And there was a lady there that looked like Kris Kardashian, and like her costume was like, it wasn't a costume. She just really looked like her. So I wonder what happened, like, the next day, you know, when she didn't want to look like that anymore because she got, like, the haircut. She was wearing the dress. I'm sure she didn't take it off. I mean, it might be a good, you know, that might be a good business, look-alike business. I wonder is there anyone out there that looks like someone? Go to our Facebook page and post a picture of yourself if you look like someone famous and then let us judge you, which would be fun because we'll make fun of you. And if you have a good sense of humor about yourself, and you don't mind being made fun of, you'll have a great time. So my guest today is the exact opposite of someone I know very well, someone I've only met in passing, but I've known about for a long time, and was actually kind of nervous about asking her to come on because to me she's very famous, and I guess, you know, we're all just kind of in the same boat here making music, and luckily she made me feel at ease. My guest for episode 22 is Mrs. Kelly Willis, and she came over to the house We didn't go meet anywhere. She wasn't scared to come here. She liked the art. I think she liked the art. Yeah, she did like the art. Here in the house, which is my lovely Jessie. Most of it's Jessie's. The really good stuff is me. Like the crooked house and stuff. Anyway, so she came by. And she's about to start making a new record. And this record she's doing with her husband, Bruce. And she also has a Christmas show coming up at the Paramount with her husband, Bruce. It's a duo show. It's the Bruce and Kelly Christmas show. So anyway, I hope you enjoy this. Episode 22, my guest, Kelly Willis.
Wait, her husband is Bruce Willis?
No.
History runs pretty deep with you and me. There were times we thought it ended, times we fought out in the street. And baby, we knocked each other upside down. Yeah, the winds of change were blowing wild. The rumors got
to get this out of the way first. When I first lived in Austin, I saved this story before we started so I could surprise you with it or ambush you with it. I can't remember where I was, but I was looking through People magazine and it had like the 50 most beautiful people in the world, and you were in there, and I will say I wholeheartedly agreed with the people at People magazine. I was like, wow, you know, they're right. This is a And then one day, you did a showcase or something at Steamboat, and I didn't even know, I didn't associate your name. And then you were at that show, and that was probably why I was really starstruck for a long time.
Oh,
until now when you came over.
Well, that's funny.
Yeah,
that was really shocking and weird. It was a really weird time. I'd just been dropped by MCA, and then that happened. I don't know. It was just a bizarre little experience.
What did that do? I mean, did you get, like, people come up? I mean, did you get, like, you know, were there new fans? Were there creepy people?
God, I don't think so.
Did I say anything creepy?
No.
I'm just joking.
No, I think mostly I was kind of embarrassed. I felt like now people are going to talk about that, and there's no way I could actually ever live up to something like that, you know? And, you know, just it was awkward, I thought.
Yeah. Those things are just weird.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, at least you survived it.
I did.
Yeah. And you're here. This is Kelly Willis. She's my guest today. You said you're starting to work on an album now.
Yeah. Bruce and I are in the process of making a record together. We've never really done that. We did a Christmas record.
Right.
And because we've always done these holiday shows.
Yeah.
But this is the first time where we've been willing to actually co-create music.
So have you not done that together?
No, what we'll do is we'll trade songs when we play together.
Right.
Or we'd sing on each other's records, that kind
right,
of thing, or
right,
I'll record
right.
one of his songs or something, but we've never like
right.
wanted to create it together and be involved in how it's going to sound and, you know, like make a genuine
yeah.
duo project or
yeah.
band project. So it's a pretty big step for us. You know, yeah. I think for years we just wanted to establish our own careers.
Sure.
We weren't interested in being in a band together.
Sure, but you make music that meshes well together, so there's no reason
right.
why, you know.
Yeah.
But I mean, I do understand that personal, I mean, you know, you live together, you parent together, you
right.
are married.
Right. That's all enough.
Yeah, it's a lot.
And being in a band is just...
And then being in a band.
Ooh, that's hard. That's hard too.
Yeah.
So
it's a whole
scary.
New level of resentment.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of scary.
Yeah.
But it's been really fun because we're just trying to come up with a sound, you
yeah.
know? And
A different sound than what you guys have had before.
Yeah, and I don't really know if we're going to achieve that, but it's been fun trying to. And we're trying to... What I hate when I play with Bruce is that half the time I have nothing to do. And we both play acoustic guitar, right. So we both hate just being jangly right, up there, right. Too much of that. So
yeah.
We're kind of doing it where I get to do that because that's all I can do, uh-huh. Is be that guitar player. And he's doing other stuff, but I always feel like I have a part, a right. role in
something
the band.
To do. Yeah,
it's
yeah.
important, and I'm not just standing up there.
Jingle jangling.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's been fun.
That's good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, those are always good things to work out. So on this last record that you put out, the song that we just heard, did you write that song?
I did. I wrote that with Chuck Prophet and Jules Shear.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. I've heard a lot about Chuck Prophet. And
yeah.
I follow him on Twitter, like I follow you. Both of you guys are very funny. Jules Shear, that's pretty amazing. What's he like?
He was really cool. He was kind of, he doesn't co-write very much. So I think, you know, and I don't even write very much. So I think we were all in the room kind of looking at each other like, is this going to work? But, and a little intimidated by trying to
yeah.
bare your soul in front of each other. But,
so you don't write a lot?
I'm not prolific. Mm-mm.
But do you write your songs on your records?
I end up writing about half of them.
Okay.
It's just, it takes me a long time.
Yeah.
You know, Bruce will write, he writes constantly. And it's, so in comparison, I always feel like that's not really one of my strong suits. You know,
right.
I do feel a strong need to have written at least half the material because
yeah.
I feel like there needs to be some point of view and some focus to a record, but I do also feel like I'm more of a singer than a songwriter, and I love singing other people's songs.
Yeah.
And
you're an incredible singer.
Oh, thanks. You are.
It's really, really, really great.
Well, thank you.
Well, let's, you were born in Lawton, Oklahoma.
Yeah.
At least according to Wikipedia. You're the youngest of three kids. What was your household like? Was it crazy? Or was there a lot of order because of the military?
Right. It was a little of both, I guess. My dad was gone a lot when I was little. Mm-hmm. And then my parents divorced when I was 9, and my mom moved and left. So I grew up from 9 on with my dad.
Wow.
So it wasn't crazy. I don't remember anything crazy. My older brothers and sisters might have. But for me, it was just very, my dad was at work all the time. It was quiet. And I was 5 years younger than my next sibling.
Oh, really?
So I was alone a lot. It wasn't crazy at all. It was really kind of dull.
What did you when were they music people, your parents? Did you go visit your mom or anything? I'm sorry, I'm gonna get
yeah.
you went to visit. It wasn't like
sometimes
when a mom leaves, mm-hmm. and the kids were left with the dad, there was always some kind of like thing where maybe the mom had like a midlife crisis and wanted to
yeah.
just get away and be free and not.
I think that was part of it for sure.
Really?
Think at that era, it was the, you know, women's lib 70s,
yeah,
and
yeah,
a lot of moms
yeah.
were leaving, I
right.
think. And, she went off to pursue acting in New York and then moved to California. So she was far away. And so I'd see her once a year
wow.
for 2 weeks. And that was about it.
Did she do anything with acting? Did she?
She did a lot of theater and stuff.
Yeah.
And until she... And, now she's been too ill to be able to do much, but
I'm sorry to hear
she
that.
Kind of had some health problems that got in the way of all that stuff. But she had a really good time of it and
good.
Enjoyed it.
But. So you stuck to yourself. Did you listen? How did you stumble across music? Like when did music first like make you want to make music, or
right
open up your heart in some way?
Well, music. You know, my mother being in plays and stuff, she was in plays before she left.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to be in them with her as an extra.
Okay.
And they were musicals, you know. So, I don't know, music was always around. But it probably wasn't until I was in high school and my girlfriends and I got to hang out with the cool guys one night.
Right,
and they
right.
left a tape in my car. And it had a T-Bone Burnett's, you know, that... Watch Out for the Trap Door record.
No.
Remember any of that? Oh, it was
when
cool
was that?
Electric stuff. Oh, that was that was like in the early 80s or mid 80s when I got that tape, but I don't know when that stuff was recorded.
Okay.
But it was just, different. Yeah. You know, nothing I'd ever heard on the radio. And they were in a rockabilly band. And there was a rockabilly scene in Austin, in D.C. I was in the D.C. area.
Oh, okay.
So it had some stuff on the other side that's rockabilly music. And
did you write that song Teddy Boys on your last record?
No, I didn't. Okay. Adam Green wrote that. Okay. But so that was just, I don't know, that was eye-opening. And I was started actually dating, Moss Palermo was my first husband. And
okay.
He was one of those guys, and I started dating him, and just
that. He was
just
one of those guys.
Oh my God! He was one of the guys that night left that tape in my van.
Oh, okay.
In my car.
Okay.
So, yeah, that was.
So, did you play an instrument at that point, or did you Mm-mm. did you sing or anything? I mean, outside of the extra musical stuff.
No, none of that.
So what did you do? What steps did you take? What did you?
Well, the band that Moss was in broke up, and okay. then they reformed and needed a singer, and he pushed me on them.
So that's good.
I was that girlfriend who's now going to be the singer, right. unfortunately, but it worked out okay. Nobody seemed to hate it too much.
Good.
Yeah.
And maybe your talent outweighed the issues of that sort
Our
of thing.
Our necessity.
Were you young? How old were you when you did that?
I was 17.
Oh, wow. You were.
Yeah, really young.
So did you guys play out? Like, did you guys have some sort of modicum of success or anything like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, we started playing. We named ourselves Kelly and the Fireballs.
That's a good name.
And we started playing around there. There were a few different clubs. I'm trying to remember what they were called. But the Twist and Shout was the main place we used to play in Bethesda, one of our big places to play. And then we moved here pretty quickly. I moved here when I was 19.
Okay.
So.
You moved here on your own?
With the band, straight out of high school.
Oh, okay, okay. But not with your parents or anything.
No.
Okay. So straight out of high school, you moved here. And how long did you last when you moved here? Not very long.
As a band, Kelly and the Fireballs. Six months, probably.
Okay.
And I met, the band had met the Wagoneers before. They had come down to visit.
Uh-huh.
And the Wagoneers were big on the scene at that time.
In D.C.?
No, here.
Okay, okay.
They had come down to visit, and they met the Wagoneers here. And so when we moved down, we kind of had some connections through them. And we met their manager, Carlin Major.
Uh-huh.
And when I started talking with her, that's when, you know, things just got uncomfortable with our little band. Everyone started disagreeing. But working with Carlin was the next... I mean, things took off incredibly fast for me once I started working with her.
Right. And you got signed pretty fast to MCA. Did you put a band together and showcase, or did you? Mm-hmm. Were you writing then, or did you?
No, at that time Moss was writing.
Okay.
And
you continued to do your thing with Moss.
Yeah, Moss stayed, and because Moss and I were dating, and Moss and I moved forward and created the next band together, which had David Murray playing guitar and Mike Hardwick.
I rehearsed at his studio.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's awesome.
I like Mike Hardwick a lot.
Yeah, Mike Hardwick. He was so cool. And Brad Fordham and played bass. And we brought him down from Canada, actually. He was living in Canada and moved here to play with us. So, and started doing some showcases. At the time, it was weird because I was so naive about the music business, and I didn't consider myself a country artist or a country singer even. And I didn't know that there was a difference between Nashville recording companies and L.A. ones and New York ones. How could they be different if they're MCA? Right. You know, it just was really beyond me at that time. So it was just an education, figuring all this
stuff out. Was it hard? I mean, learning that shit? Was it like, you know, did you get, you know, I mean, what happened?
Oh, I was just confused by it, you know, and publishing. I'm like, what? Yeah, you can have... all the no money I'm making off the half song I've written.
Right.
That all of that stuff was just not what I wasn't interested in any of that, you know?
Right.
So, but it was a real education. It was really exciting going up there and meeting all these powerful people. And,
And so what happened? You put out a record or you made a record. Did you make a record out there? Did they let you keep your band? Did they do weird stuff and like,
they did let me use the band on the first record.
Right, okay.
And I think, you know, at the time that mentality of let them get it out of their system kind of thing was what they were doing. But, I signed with them and made a record. And then there was all kinds of pressure to be using studio musicians and to be recording radio, big hit singles, and
what kind of pressure? Because did they go to Carlin or did they go to Carlin and then feign, oh, we just talked to you. But as soon as Carlin went to pee or something, they come to you and corner you and listen, we need a hit out of you.
No, I don't know. I have no idea if they were devious or not. I'm sure that they were, but they were putting a lot of money into it, and there was a certain return they were expecting, and I was a pet project. I was Tony Brown's pet project, so I had some leeway at the time, but that's why I think
By leeway, do you mean you had some say in what you would do with your own career?
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, they were letting me get away with stuff that other people would never get away with.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
But, it was always a struggle, and I was I just felt like I was letting them down on a daily basis because I was not able to be the kind of person they wanted. I wasn't someone who could go to a radio station and chat people up and tell little stories. I could hardly talk. I mentioned before, I had really serious social phobia.
Wow.
So it was awkward. Moss had a huge role in my life at that time, and that he kind of spoke for me because I just couldn't pull it together. I would be a deer in the headlights in any kind of situation like that. So
yeah,
it was just weird.
And wow.
It was a real, probably in this day and age, somebody would have put me on some medication. There's a pill for everything now. But I'm really glad that it didn't happen now because I kind of just had to get out there and work through it. And I just had to get on the road and talk to people at radio stations. And
yeah, you seem totally right. Fine now.
I am pretty much fine now, but I do still have some old habits that die hard. But I worked through it the way
you should.
The old-fashioned way. I think the way that you should. It's hard, but
I think people like us, I assume that we're probably relatively within a year or two the same age. But you have kids. I don't know if this is somewhere we want to go with this conversation, but I'm always fascinated with the amount of medication people give themselves and give their children. And I read these things about kids being bipolar, little kids, and all this kind of stuff that, I never took any of that stuff. And I was, pretty crazy.
Yeah. And do you think
good?
You worked through whatever?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I never have. Even, some moments, things, horrible things have happened in my life that I've had to deal with later on when a therapist would actually say to me, you should take this medication. Well, first of all, I'll be honest with you. I'm Hispanic, and I don't ever want to have sexual issues down there because of some medicine I'm taking.
Yeah.
That was the number one thing. But the other thing too is the old fashioned way. How did my grandpa had to deal with all kinds of shit, and he's probably manic depressive.
Right. Well,
and bipolar.
And I'm sure that there are some people, and I know that there are some people who really should be on medication and it really helps and helps their life immensely. But
I
just
everyone.
Don't think that it was for me.
Right.
And not everyone.
Yeah.
And yeah.
So you you went out on the road and you met a lot of people, and how did the record fare? Did it do well or did it?
It was we were always well received by the critics.
Yeah.
But
I've noticed that about you.
Never really had much commercial success, and so no, I had hardly any record sales.
Did you do TV shows and stuff? Were you on
Yeah, I did all the little country talk shows.
Crook and
Nashville
Chase.
Now. I did Crook and Chase.
Yeah.
And did something up in Canada, I remember, where they had you, just some crazy show where you run, they have music playing and the guests have to run out and stand in the spotlight, some kind of crazy hee-haw thing. And then when you play, you have to do it to tracks, and you sing.
Oh, what's that like?
It was weird.
Yeah.
It was just strange.
Was it just you?
Just me.
And then the sound of a band and no mm-hmm. microphone or anything and nothing was plugged in? Or how far did they try to make it seem real?
Well, I did actually sing.
Okay,
so that
okay,
was
so
the deal.
Music was canned.
The music was canned. And it was odd because I was not used to being... I was always in a band, you know, yeah. played in clubs and stuff.
And at this point, it wasn't very long that you'd been doing it, right? Maybe right. 3 years or something?
Yeah.
Wow. And you were right there.
Yeah.
I hung out with Tina Yothers. You know who I'm talking about?
Yeah.
She's from Family Ties. Years ago, and she was telling me about her first gig. We were talking about, you know, getting into music. Her brother, she has a band with her brother. It's mm-hmm. called, or was called Jaded then. Anyway, so her brother's named Corey. And Corey and I were talking about, like, you know, just kind of like the natural sort of coming up in a band. And you do this, and things don't happen fast, you know.
Right.
And and so I was like, well, what about you, Tina? And she's like, well, I was on a television show, and somebody was trying to capitalize on something. I remember somebody going like, hey, you're going to go to the studio and sing. And so she went into the studio, and she sang, and then a couple of months later, they're like, oh, we're going to take your pictures and all this stuff. And I'm like, oh, we're going to Miami because you're going to do a concert. And she's like, oh, I'm going to do a concert. It was opening for Menudo at the Orange Bowl, sold out.
Oh, my God.
So it was like... She like went from like nut like, oh, I went and sang this thing, and then all of a sudden, right. you know, she was there. Did you feel like it was that fast, and maybe you were spinning a little bit, or did you have like, this is the way it happens all the time?
Well, no, I knew that it was really cool that good things were happening, but I did have a couple of years playing in bars and stuff and having nobody come out, and I did. That was where, you know, my goal when I first started was I wanted to have a really great. Be a big regional band. I loved like Evan Johns and the H-Bombs and Dash Rip Rock, and that was really what I was after, was something like that. So, you know, that's what I was going for. We were playing all these bars and getting on these TV shows was really weird.
Yeah.
You know, to me, I was a little worried that this isn't really going to get me where I want to be, you know?
Right.
And
that's interesting that you saw it like that, because usually that's like the end.
Yeah.
You know, that's the goal for a lot of people.
Right. Well, and I did, in hindsight, I really was able to see all these amazing opportunities and that they really laid the groundwork for me to have a career for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
You know, whatever kind of career I want to try to make, you know.
Yeah.
But, even though it was really awkward and I wasn't really ready for this opportunity, I gained a lot from it.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's all you can really hope for.
Yeah.
So so then what happened? Did you go make a second record, or did that record sell so badly they gave you the boot then?
No, I got to make... I actually made three records.
Oh, you made
with
three.
Them.
Okay, sorry.
Well, like I said, I was this pet project, so even though I wasn't selling, I got... Tony kept me around to, you know, give
it another
shot.
Was he the president or something?
He was the... I think he was the vice president when I signed there, and he became the president later. And he'd worked with Lyle Lovett and Nancy Griffith at that label before, and they had all been kicked off and sent to California MCA.
Right.
So, I think I was their attempt to meld that world with the Nashville world. You know,
right.
This person in the middle.
This is a good question, because Nancy Griffith and Lyle Lovett, was their thing not Nashville enough to be there? So
yeah, it wasn't.
Because they were
Nashville
crossing
enough.
Over at the time. I mean,
they were really good, genuine artists, you know, but they
just... They were kind of I don't remember Nancy Griffith so much being on like VH1, but Lyle was on there a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Yeah, and I can't understand why they wouldn't want that, but they didn't, you know, and I think everybody like that was getting shipped off to the LA counterparts.
And so then what, I remember that, and it's like almost like it became, and the funniest thing is that probably in a traditional sense, that these people were playing truer country music than Achy Breaky Heart was probably what was going, or around, like maybe a little bit before then or something, right?
Yeah.
Early 90s or something?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were, and Steve Earle was on MCA. They were making really great music that all people liked, you know.
Right.
It wasn't just, you didn't have to be in a certain category to like it, you know, it was appealing in some way. So,
right.
But that's not what they do there. You know, they like, they want to make a lot of money, right. And they want to have an artist that they right. can really kind of have a serious hand in directing what they do and say and saying. And
right.
So.
Did you align yourselves, or align yourself more with them, with Wild Love It and with
Nancy Griffin? I did. I was really hoping to have that kind of experience. You know, I was hoping to be that kind of artist. I really wasn't ready for this opportunity.
Right.
And I didn't have that kind of talent. But I wanted, that's what I wanted to do. And right. that's, I was so excited to
you
be at MCA.
You were aware that they were in a different place than probably what your direct competition and in Nashville was, right?
I guess I did. I mean, I knew that I wasn't that talented, but I wanted to be.
Right. And I don't mean it on a level of talent. I just mean like in what you're doing and like, hey, I'm a little bit more like, I want to be more like these guys than what's happening in Nashville.
Exactly. I did know that.
Right.
But I thought it was possible. Right. Yeah. I didn't know that that it wasn't going to be
right.
possible. That and they weren't going to want me to do that.
Right. So what was happening at the time? Like you did your second record and mm-hmm. were they, what was going on? What did you do? Did you tour with other country acts opening for them, or did you kind of...
You know, I didn't really get on any great co-bills or anything like that, but I did random dates with other big artists.
Right.
And so I was playing some fairs and festivals, that kind of thing, and also mixing it in with some genuine bars and clubs as well.
Okay.
And... videos were big at that time.
Yeah.
And I was making videos. The videos would get played all the time, but nobody would play me on the radio. So I was like a big video star, a big country video star for
right.
a couple of years, but not a radio.
That's weird that happened with country music, because it seems like early in the 80s, like maybe a year after MTV came out, then radio kind of stopped being so regional. Because remember, there'd be regional. There'd be a song mm-hmm. that'd be huge here.
Right.
But you'd go somewhere else and they'd never even heard the song.
Right.
And that kind of like leveled this playing field, because radio just reacted to what MTV was playing. So it's weird that they didn't do that with CMT.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe eventually they did that.
Do you think so?
I don't know. Once I got out of there, I kind of got out of there. I didn't want to be a part of. I didn't even want to know what was happening there after that.
Right. And so you did that. You went and made a third record. Were you starting to realize that maybe this, when did you start realizing maybe this is not the place for me? Right after you signed.
Yeah. Now, making the third record was really, it was interesting because Don came in and co-produced that record.
I read that.
And so that was kind of, Moss and I divorced.
Okay.
We got married and divorced, and I was actually genuinely having to become a solo artist. All this time I'd been part of
right.
a group of people at least, and I really had to step out and, you know, be responsible for myself here. So that was really a interesting time. And working with Don, I felt like I had somebody in my corner.
That's good.
Because he worked very differently than they did in Nashville, and he was, you know, more about getting interesting creative takes as opposed to perfect ones.
Right.
And
character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I just felt like I had somebody, you know, because the folks in Nashville really looked up to him too and really valued his opinion. So, you
right.
know, what he would say would go. And
right.
I remember just looking around sometimes when he would decide to do something and being amazed that everyone was going along with it.
Yeah.
And I can't even give you a specific example. It was
no,
just
but I understand
different.
The general vibe.
Yeah.
I listened to this great interview with him and, I don't want to say Bob Boylan, a guy that does All Songs Considered on NPR. It was just kind of like a 45-minute thing of them going through Exile on Main Street and everything that he redid to that record to kind of bring it out. And he seemed like right. a really soulful and very cool
guy. He is.
You guys stay in touch, did you, or no?
No, I actually haven't seen him in years.
Yeah.
But it was a great, great experience.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I wanted to before we pass this, and I haven't gotten a chance to really talk to a lot of women about this, but you said that, that when Moss left, then you had to kind of essentially assert yourself somewhat. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So before you had been kind of this probably demure, I wouldn't say, you know, just from what you've described. Okay, so a quiet and goes along, and maybe Moss would say something every now and then. It's a difficult line to cross for a woman, because you'll become, in the eyes of the people that, that are employing you at that point, a bitch, right? Mm-hmm. Because you've all of a sudden like, hey, I don't want to do this. I want to work with, you know, so-and-so. Did you feel that? Did you?
Yeah, a little bit. I felt...
And what does that feel like?
Well, you know,
because I'm a dude.
I'm kind of embarrassed that I was never one of these go-getter type people. The people I always loved were like Maria McKee and Lone Justice and Wanda Jackson, you know, these really aggressive women who are, you know, feisty or something. And
yeah.
I wanted to be that so bad. So when I talk about it, I'm embarrassed that I was so quiet and mousy and that I was so worried about somebody not liking me, you know, that I would be afraid that if I said something that there would be a conflict, you know, that we might have a fight. And I just, I couldn't stand the idea of that. So it really was little by little over the years that I got accustomed to people not liking me and got okay with that. And actually now I feel like if somebody doesn't like me, I'm probably doing something good. And I'm proud of having an opinion and, you know, asserting it and all that. But so looking back on it, it's kind of embarrassing that I...
Well, no, it's interesting just to talk to someone who's gone through all of this growth that you make as a person into adulthood in public.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. I mean, that's pretty... And you seem very together and calm. I mean, I don't know how much weed you smoked on the way here, but... None. Okay, well...
None. But these days I feel very together.
No.
I know what I want to do. And
so you made the Don Was record, and what was the public response? The critics love that record as well? They've loved everything you've done, haven't they?
They did, yeah.
That's awesome.
I've always had great response.
Yeah.
Occasional, you know, dissenting opinion. But
occasional
mostly,
idiot.
Yeah.
No, I'm joking.
Screw that guy. We've had really good critical response to things that we've done, I didn't have any, it didn't ever connect until I did my What I Deserve record. After I left MCA, or MCA dropped me.
Okay, so they dropped you.
Yeah.
And how did you find out? Fax? Call from Carlin? Were you still with Carlin?
No.
Okay.
Carlin and I had split ways, but I got a...
Fax?
Phone call.
Oh.
I got a phone call. Did I get a phone call? No, the manager I was working with at the time had gotten a call and called me and told me. And I remember I was really upset that Tony Brown didn't call me and tell me, because, you know, we were just tight.
Yeah.
And it's
weird when that happens.
Yeah, because you think that they're all your friends.
Yeah.
You're on this label and they're so nice to you.
Yeah.
And then the day that it's over, it is over.
Did you see that Wilco movie?
No.
The, it's amazing. I'm starting to think Sam. So, anyway, it's this black and white movie, I'm Trying to Break Your Heart. And so there's a point where they do get dropped, and Jeff Tweedy's sitting in his room, and they're like, well, what's going, you know, it's just kind of alone. And he's like, man, the worst part about it is my feelings are really hurt. I thought all those people were my friends. Like, I understand having to let me go, but they all didn't answer my calls, and they turned their back on me, and they're not my friends. And I actually believed that these people, I did too when I was in that same situation. I mean, I thought, I was astonished when my former A&R guy got out of a cab at South by Southwest a couple of years after my whole experience, looked at me and turned around real fast, pretending like he hadn't. I was like, really?
That's just shocking.
Yeah.
And it's the way it is.
It's so textbook too.
Yeah.
It's like, you're a cliche.
Yeah.
And now he's like the president of a label, and he used to be a drummer of a cool band. So it's like, you know what I mean? It's like the dissension.
Yeah.
I remember him. It was his first A&R job, and he would always say things like, I'm not a weasel, and don't introduce people to me as your A&R guy, because I'm a musician. Mm. I was like, yeah, well, that's fading.
Yeah, it is really shocking.
Yeah.
And now I see it with other people, you know, and you think, there are artists who are just flying high, and I think, you know, well, they have no idea how circumstantial their relationships are with those people. Yeah. And you don't find that out until you fail in some way. Right. And that's why all these failures are just so important, and they're just great. You have to have those. And
yeah.
I think they make you a better artist and person.
So what did you do? Did you mourn a bit and like, oh, what am I going to do now? Or did you go like, okay, well now I'm going to, whatever your next move was.
Well, you know, I kind of knew it was coming.
Right.
We knew that if that record didn't work, that was it.
Right.
It just came a little earlier in the playbook than I thought. I thought I had one more single. So I was taken off guard because of that, but I was ready to be done with Nashville. And
were you living there?
No, I was living here, but I was just ready to be done with that world.
I never saw you anywhere.
Really?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't remember seeing you like at places.
Hmm. I can't explain that.
Okay, sorry, go ahead.
I mean, I got out at some point. But there were some years I was out before I had all these babies. But I was excited to go out and see what opportunities.
Right. How old were you when that ended?
24.
That's funny. And Kathy's, when we were talking, she was talking about how the Go-Go's broke up. It was the end of her life, and she was 25 years old.
Yeah.
So
I was worried about being an almost never was, has been kind of person at that age. So.
Yeah. Yeah. So what did you do?
Well, I just, that's when I started working with Davis McLarty, started booking me. And I just went out there and started gigging. I had to play gigs, genuinely play gigs for a living, instead of getting any record company money. So, started writing some songs. And I met Teresa Ensenat. She had actually worked at MCA with Steve Earle and had been married to Steve Earle at some point, but she was an A&R person there at Geffen. That's what it was. And then she was working at A&M and signed me to A&M.
Oh, really?
Yeah. In LA. And through her, I got to do, it was only a year that I was on that label, but I got some amazing pre-production work done for my What I Deserve record. And she would set me up with people to write with. We'd sit around and...
Who'd you write with? Anyone cool?
Gary Louris and I wrote some songs
together.
Wow,
that's awesome.
Yeah. And that was the only real successful liaison there. But I did record with Sunvolt. And I did some recording with Glenn Johns producing.
Wow.
And so...
What was that like? Was he... I've heard a couple of different things about him.
He was really cool.
He wasn't wasted or anything?
No. Okay. He was totally on his game. And we recorded in Memphis at that studio there. What's that?
Sun Studio?
No.
Muscle Shoals or something?
No. What's the big star?
Oh, Ardent.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome.
And so that was really cool. And I had some meetings with T-Bone Burnett.
Yeah.
I was really terrified. I wanted him to produce my record. And meeting with him, I was completely in over my head talking to him. He would talk music theory and stuff. And
I want that guy to be my big brother. Like, seriously, I've listened to his Fresh Air interview about 11 times.
Oh,
I'm
really?
Not kidding you. Like, when I feel bad, I listen to him.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I was
I want to be his friend so bad. It's crazy.
Scared by him. And I thought, oh, I don't know. I'm just going to get swallowed up if we work together. And I really... loved what
he's a
he was
giant
doing.
Guy too,
yeah, right? Really tall,
yeah.
And but right about that time is when A&M did some reshuffling and everybody got they let everybody go,
right?
Even all the A&R people all got let go,
right?
So
was that when the building was closing?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
So and then that was that, but I got to take all that work and I met a guy named Jeff Travis who had, you remember Rough Trade Records?
Yeah. Yeah, I do.
That was his deal, and he was in England, and he gave me the money to make a record.
Did you do well in Europe? Did you tour in Europe throughout that whole MCA time?
I never toured over there. I've gone over there after I made What I Deserve and did some radio
stuff. The next record that you made was What I Deserve. Mm-hmm. And you made that on your own and then sold it to Rough Trade, or you made it with Rough Trade already in the...
They put the money up to make it.
And what year did that come out?
98?
Okay.
99? Something like that.
And so you toured behind that, and it mm-hmm. of course, the critics probably loved it.
Yeah, that was my most successful record. I sold over 100,000 copies.
Wow.
I know. It was phenomenal.
And when you do it on a smaller level like that, then 100,000 copies is actually successful as opposed to...
Right. Being at MCA, I'd only ever sold like 15,000 per album, and their goal was to sell, a million.
Right. Yeah.
So it was really satisfying to be...
I bet.
To make the music that I wanted to make, I was so in charge of that whole thing.
Completely different than the last time.
Oh, yeah. And I had to, it was just making music, and I made this record, and I had a lot of help from a lot of really talented musicians and
people.
Sure,
but you were probably a lot more involved, and it was more of your vision than somebody else's, right?
Exactly. Well, I was looking at it as my swan song, too. I thought, I'll never get to make another one, so I want to make the one that defines me, that I can hang my hat on and say, well, that was my music career. So it was really...
What were you going to do?
I don't know. I just didn't know that there would be any more opportunity.
Right.
So I was just... It was just important to me to get it right. And then to have it do better than anything I'd ever done, and to be on an independent label and all that. It was just really satisfying.
Yeah, that was very satisfying. So did you tour a lot? Did you tour with a band?
I did. We toured constantly.
Yeah.
And, I had a great band. And Amy Ferris was in my band at that time. I don't know if you ever knew her, but fiddle player. And the two of us really kind of created a great sound together. She did the harmony vocals, and I'd never had harmony vocals before. So that was really a great union the two of us had. And so that was a great, fun time in my life.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so then did you meet Bruce then? By then, you guys were married, or
you guys together? I met Bruce in 91 when I was making my second record for MCA. So we dated off and on. We broke up a couple of major big breakups in there, but
are there songs out there that people can go in and check out? Breakup and get back together.
Bruce has got some.
Bruce has got some.
I think Bruce is wrapped and not forgotten you or about all that stuff, but.
Can I throw something out really fast?
Yeah.
Is that you were saying that you recorded in Ardent, you referenced Big Star, and I noticed that both in yours and Bruce's music, there is a heavy, it's not so fiddle, pedal, steel as much as like a country-ish Big Star song, or like people that listen to Elvis Costello. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. It's not a real retro sound.
Do you see yourselves like that? No, not a retro sound, but also not like a real... Not a real country sound.
Right.
It's informed a lot more by pop.
Yeah, definitely. I've always liked just great
songs. Everly Brothers kind of thing, yeah.
Yeah. I would say it's not real standard sounding country. But
right.
I look at Bruce's stuff as being more country than mine, but his stuff, it's just a kind of a modern take on a traditional... style of music, his songs are definitely country songs. They're the harmonies are what makes them so much fun, and the melodies. And he doesn't write, his lyrics are like, exactly what he's saying. It's not like some hidden meaning in
it tells
an exact story, and it's poetry.
Right.
And
my stuff's
not quite like that.
Yeah.
My stuff's a little more kind of journal entry when I write.
Yeah.
A little more like, here's this thing that happened to me. And but I like a little more vague lyric than he does sometimes. And that's, I think, more of a pop sound. I think that's pop music.
Yeah.
So, and a lot of the songs that I covered aren't considered country songs. I just thought, I like bringing a pop song and putting a country element to it and making it a unique thing all its own.
And I think your delivery then also in your singing will naturally give it that
a country sound.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't mean that in any weird way.
Well, no, that was in the very beginning when I started working with Carlin that she said, well, you have a country voice. There's nothing you can do about it. That's just, when you sing country, that sounds better than anything else you sing. So,
I don't know why. I just wanted you to pick up my guitar and start singing Poker Face by Lady Gaga, if you could, just to see what that sounds like. So after that record, then you went in and made another record pretty soon thereafter.
Yeah, I guess it was maybe, well, it might have been more like 4 or 5 years later.
Yeah, you're slow.
I'm very slow. Well, I started having kids.
Yeah.
And then
after that first record?
Or? Yeah, 2001, I had my first kid, my first son. And that was just really hard for me to juggle both those worlds.
Yeah.
And I tried to quit a couple times. Like,
tried to quit motherhood or
both, probably. Music. I just thought, I can't do both of these things well. So something's got to give. And I tried to quit music maybe twice. But
at that time, was that the time, I'm sorry to be like offensive, but you were... I don't stalk you in any way, just so you know. Okay. Was that like you were doing, like how serious I was when I said that? I'm really worried that I'm going to give you the wrong impression.
Don't worry about it.
Was that the time you did like there was a Henna Chevrolet commercial. There mm-hmm. was also, I can't remember when there was an allergy medicine commercial, but there was one of those. I mean, you know, shit, that's good. You can do that stuff because I bet, you know. Yeah. Makes it so you don't have to go out and leave your kids behind and go play for, you know, a month and a half.
The Claritin commercial was after 6 weeks Claritin. After I'd had my last baby, and I hadn't worked in 3 months, and this thing just fell in our lap, and we just said, yeah, I'll do it. So,
yeah. How do things like that fall on your lap? Because that is, I mean, did you get an audition or did they come and go like, hey, we want you guys?
Yeah. They just called us. I had to have been written for somebody that it was written for a duo. We really thought maybe it was written for somebody like Brooks and Dunn or someone who backed out of it and they needed somebody. Cause it was like, we need
That's
somebody
really creepy,
next week.
Cause I like a couple more than like the,
right.
The dude singing. It's like the guys from Air Supply have allergies.
Right. Who knows what it was written for, right. But it was last minute. And, I was all still pretty heavy from having the baby, strapped on a girdle, went out there. Like, yep.
So how did that, I mean, obviously that changed your, how you deliver, you know, the timeline with which you deliver music. So, how do you juggle that? Like, how did that, did you just, you mother until you got to make a record or, I mean, is that,
that's kind of how I do it. I'm not a good multitasker. Before I had kids, it would take all of my attention and energy to create music, you know, every waking moment,
right.
Really focused on it.
It's also fun to be like that, you know, it makes it more worth it when you're doing it.
Yeah.
So
having kids, I'm totally distracted. I'm exhausted. I mean, I'm finally at a point now, the youngest is 5. That I'm getting sleep, but I was like chronically sleep deprived for 8 years and overstimulated. You know, part of having this, all this social phobia is, you know, I'm kind of hypersensitive to, you know, noise, what? Light.
Oh, yeah.
Tension, you know, so I'm also chronically overstimulated by crying kids and fighting kids, you know, just completely worn down and trying to create music and make a record in that atmosphere was really a challenge.
Yeah, you just stressed me out. I will not create anything for 2 months now because of this.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. Then I commend you because through that time, then you've also put out some records. Like, when did, so you made a record, you said 5 years after.
Yeah, I guess it was about 5 years. Let me think, 2002. So yeah. 98, something. Yeah, and that one I produced myself.
How was that?
It was fun. It was stressful.
Are, producing, you hired the engineers. Did you call a lot of shots sonically? I mean, did you choose like what mics were going to go on what?
No.
Or you left that to an engineer or something like that? But you oversaw.
I hired Gary Pachosa to be the engineer.
Oh.
And I also asked him to co-produce with me to be someone to bounce off.
Right.
But he took care of all that. You know, that was his world. And together we figured out who to hire. You know, I've always really, one of my strengths, I think, is that I can put together a group of talented people. And, you know, I feel like I understand.
It's an incredible talent.
I understand all of the importance of each of their roles in the room.
Right.
And so I got to, you know, put the band together and...
So before, let me ask you this: in the dynamic of a band, did you had a musical director, someone who kind of handled the execution of the songs live, or did you run that?
I run that too.
Okay,
yeah. not very well.
Right.
But yeah,
right.
No, I've never had
there are
anybody
some people
that does
that. There's people that I met that I think are like that actually aren't, and then there's things like, you know, it's the best example that I ever have ever seen is that Michael Jackson movie.
Yeah, I didn't see that.
You didn't see it.
Mm-mm.
There's just this part where he's like, hey, you know, the way that you are, like the feel on that mm-hmm. keyboard, that like he stops the whole band. It's not something you would expect.
Right.
Because you think Michael Jackson just shows up and like moonwalks and,
right.
and does whatever he's supposed to do. But there's another guy in charge of making this
right.
music thing go on, like Madonna or something. You
right.
know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I just didn't know how in the...
Yeah, I do all that. And I'm
how much
not
of a
that
general
I
you
do
are.
It great or anything.
Right.
You can ask anybody I've ever been in a band with. I don't like to rehearse.
No.
I want us to get through the song. But I do have, you know, a ways that I want people to play stuff. You know,
yeah.
that's definitely
yeah.
something, part of my...
Okay.
Deal.
So then you made that record and you made a, did you put out singles at that point? Mm-hmm. Ryko Disc was putting out your records?
Yeah, Ryko was really on the ball for what I deserve, but they, you know, record company business had happened to them, some weird reshifting, and they were a different company for that second record. And they weren't the same people there anymore. And, so, you know, things started to go a little bit sour with them as well, only because each time I made a record, it was a completely different team of people and nobody there that even knew who I was. So we made some videos, and I had kids, so I couldn't just get out there and tour like I did with What I Deserve.
How did you tour?
I would do like 4 or 5 days. Come home for a week or two and go back out into 4 or 5 days until I had gotten to every corner of the country.
Right. And it, like Bruce would stay home when you were gone, and
mm-hmm.
then if he went out, then you would stay. And...
Exactly. And we did it like that for many years. Tag team.
Yeah.
Parenting.
That's pretty good. I mean, I'm sure it's hard. It's not easy. But I don't think any parenting is actually easy.
No.
You know what I mean?
No.
Even if you're like a, you know, bazillionaire or something, it's still some kind of...
Yeah, you're still the parent. You gotta be responsible in some way.
It's pretty intense, that responsibility. I mean, I don't have it, and I've run from it.
Mm-hmm. I don't blame you. It's scary.
I know. I have a lot of different levels. A, my dad's a dick. And second of all, like, I'm scared I would be one. And second of all, like, I lost my mom when I was a teenager, so... I have this horrible feeling that I'd be like my grandma is, like, you know, like I would probably follow the kid to school and outside and like.
Well, it is different. Our generation, we are hovering parents.
Are you?
I
are
think
you?
It's, yeah.
I think
not to be, and I think it's because we all came from a generation where we were kind of afterthoughts and to a lot of people.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the other thing is like I'm like, man, I don't know if I will. I mean, obviously, everything changes when you actually have a child. And even if you're saying what I'm saying now, what I've noticed from my friends that have done that is, you know, they're like, I used to say that. Then I had this kid. It's amazing, you know.
Oh, yeah. It is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. but just that, I would be a horrible hovering parent. So is Bruce a hovering parent too?
Less so than me, but
yeah,
he's a great dad.
Are
he's really
tall.
The oldest three seem to be in the tall group, but they're not the tallest. They're not crazy tall.
Okay.
And the youngest one, he's in the short end of the class. So I don't know what's happened. with him.
Lost chromosome.
Yeah.
So you made a video then even with my ex-wife and a pretty famous video director, right? That's that.
Which
they
one?
Did it together.
Did oh yeah, the Don't Come the
Cowboy
with
Me, Sonny Chim.
Yeah. That was, oh my god.
That became a phrase with me and my friend Einar, who's actually in the video.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, he's dancing in the video.
Don't Come Cowboy with Me.
Yeah, it was like it's like you're getting too big for your britches kind of thing. We'd say to each other.
Yeah, I was really pregnant making that video. Really? I was pregnant with the twins. So there's no shots below the waist.
So then you had twins. Wow.
Yeah.
So so that record was out. Were you playing gigs and stuff pregnant? What's that like? Aren't you like hormonal? Don't you get like, do you ever yell at the audience or anything?
No, you just get tired. It's just exhausting.
Yeah.
But, you know, you learn how to play side saddle, kind of. Call it. You play the guitar on the side.
How pregnant have you been and still played a gig?
I think I played in my 8th month.
With twins?
Not with the twins.
Okay.
But with my single pregnancies.
Okay.
Played up through the 8th month.
Wow.
Yeah.
You got to work, right?
Got to work. And you got to work until the last minute.
Yeah.
Because you won't be working for a while.
So when you had the twins then, you weren't able to really go out behind that record after that very much, or?
Let's see. Yeah, I got pregnant. I was pregnant with the twins while I was promoting the second record.
Okay.
And so then when I had the twins, I was like, oh, I can't do music anymore.
Right.
Sorry.
Okay, so that's when you, but you didn't know what you were going to do.
No.
You just needed time to mother.
Yeah.
Right, and hover.
And yeah, and just try to organize this insanity of all those kids.
Yeah.
And I'm still pretty unorganized, but not quite as stressed out.
You don't seem very stressed out. I think there's also that sort of like thing that comes with motherhood, that like sort of the thing that would stress me out, like spilling something or something, you know. No, it's just spilling, you know, right. Then those kind of things just roll off of you. You don't sweat the small stuff, so to speak, anymore.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, because that stuff's happening constantly. So you have to just
let it go.
You live
in a state of chaos.
A state of chaos. You really do.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean,
that's why I didn't want to do this at my house. I was like, oh, it's too messy.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to go to your place.
Yeah. Well, mine's colorful. Nice.
Yours is nice.
You went how many years between that and the next record? That record came out in 2002.
You put one out
in 2005?
Or six.
Or six. Your last record came out in 2007. Were there two between?
Seven. Oh, no, there's nothing between.
Okay, so there's just one other record after that.
Yeah.
And that's the one that we heard the song at the top of the thing. Tell me about that record. Did you produce that one?
No, Chuck Prophet produced it.
Okay. Tell me about Chuck Prophet, because I've heard a lot about him. And I follow him on Twitter, and he's funny.
He is funny.
Very funny.
I met him when he was in Green on Red. And I was in Europe doing a few dates and ran into him on a train, and we met there. And but then when I started to record What I Deserve, I started that project in San Francisco, and he had been hired by the producer as just a hired gun. And that's
playing guitar?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that session just went down in flames. It was awful. I had to get my tapes and go home, kind of a deal. And but when I did come home, I took him with me, so to speak. I loved how he played and how he treated my songs and what he did to my songs. It was just, it was a really great experience. And so I wanted him for sure on anything else and he's been on every record I've made ever since. And
wow.
Yeah.
And so he produced that last
record. He produced the last one. You know, making that last record, I really just said, I guess, you know, I'm so exhausted with all these babies. Now I have four of them and, you know, some horrible family planning going on there. But I've got four kids in the space of 5 years. And I just wanted somebody who I could really trust to just take the reins. And so this was the first time, really, in a long time that I just said, what do you think? What do you want to do? And we collaborated and we wrote together, and he would bring songs in, and, you know, and I would just nix them or accept them. And I would contribute a few ideas, but really I just needed him to take the reins. And
so how did that go? You went out and toured for that and stuff? Is that when you started playing with My Friend Sweeney, Our Friend Sweeney?
Yeah, because I have never had a keyboard before.
Yeah.
Really? Well, I had one song on one of my records that had a big keyboard part on it, but that's never been an instrument that I really understood. Coming from a rockabilly background,
right?
It was just kind of the basics and the ABCs of music, rockabilly, and I'd maybe hear a piano, but
yeah,
keyboards and stuff weren't a
big
instrument.
You didn't hear like a double-tiered Casio.
Right.
With the sweetest string sound and drum sounds of all time.
Exactly.
How long did you go out, and what happened with that record? Did it well critically, obviously, and did it come out? Let me ask you this, because you started making records before there was an internet and all this stuff, mm-hmm. and it's an important conversation I think to have, because sales fell off, you know.
Mm-hmm. Big time.
Yeah, they just died.
Mm-hmm.
And even how have you adapted to that?
Well, I mean, sales have never really mattered, right? I mean, I've never made enough sales where I made money off of them being on a label.
Right.
So,
right, but at one point you said that the first record that you did on your own, it sold like 100,000, right. and then it dropped back down,
right.
Probably because sales did for everyone. But if you had 100,000, you really see the drop at that point, right?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So my question is that then what did you do to keep up with the changing market, so to speak?
Well, I don't know. I haven't really done anything to keep up with the market.
You have, like, you know, obviously you're a very active tweeter.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a different.
Yeah, and that's really current though. You know, I haven't made a record since I've been that involved in anything.
Okay.
And I don't know what we're gonna do with this record Bruce and I are making. We're gonna have to figure out I guess you give stuff away, because I think you just change even thinking about that, because your motive now is just to be able to make music and to be able to have some fun making music, right? And when you go out and you play, you've got new material and you've got this new kind of little excitement.
Right. Yeah.
And that's all you really kind of can hope for at this point, I think. You can't, like, I don't understand how the music business has just imploded. It's gone, right?
Yeah.
So, I think it's changed the way we look at, if you're a musician now, that's quite a commitment, right?
Right, and it's gone from what it was like when you were on MCA, where, say, you have a manager or anything like that, but, like, mm-hmm. everybody, you're your own business now, you
yeah.
know? You are your own, everybody knows a little bit more about how many records they're selling. Everybody knows a little bit more about how much everything costs to do.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And if you're able to, and I know you guys had a studio, and that's a tough in the 2000s to put a studio together and try and turn it into a money-making venture. That's a tough thing to do, because it seems like the middle class of all of that is gone, you know, like the...
Yeah,
the mid-level studios are like, there's still Ocean Ways and Sunset Sounds, and then, you know, here.
Right, and you know, kind of as a result, there's no. Everybody's doing stuff, and there's no filter, right? You don't know.
Yeah, I have a fucking talk show.
Awesome.
No, I mean, that's what I'm saying, is like, we live in this world where
everybody's doing stuff, and someone has to tell you about it. Word of mouth. And so stuff is kind of rising to the surface,
right,
in a natural way.
Right, yeah.
But at the same time, there's nobody who's like really tuned in to know what's really good, figuring out how to get people
there
heard by others, you know? So a lot of people are hearing all kinds of stuff that they're not interested in, and then it turns them off from really continuing to listen and dig around.
That's true.
You know, it's just a weird world.
It is a weird world.
And... It seems like daily it's being changing and and getting figured out.
It's both. I mean, this is kind of off of the music stuff, but it's not. I mean, it's both getting at the exact same time, like almost at an exponentially, it's becoming both bigger and smaller.
Yeah.
And people are becoming more connected in a way to other people, but far more isolated in another way, you know?
Right. Because what? They don't have to have real interactions.
You don't have to have real interactions.
Yeah. Which is good if you have social phobia.
You're right.
But not good, because then you never get over it. But that's what I like about Twitter.
Right.
You know, is that I can actually interact with people without all the nervous craziness. But I'm excited about the whole changing world of music.
Yeah.
I think that I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
But it changes fast.
Real
music, I think, is going to get made. I mean, in some ways it's horrible in that only Taylor Swift is making records, and Beyonce, and you know, all these people that are getting a national push, or
right.
You know, record, the great thing about those big record companies is that they do give you a base. You do get some publicity and get to go, maybe they help fund a tour that you couldn't afford to do
right.
when you're brand new and nobody wants to go see you
right. because
they have never heard of you. So, you know, a lot of those people that really would nurture your career along are just gone.
Yeah.
That's not there. So yeah. I feel kind of bad for people who are trying to break into music right now. I don't know what you do.
What we're doing, I guess.
Yeah.
Really, you know. I mean, I'm still, you know, recording and writing and, you know, putting out records. I don't put as much, I literally come at, like, the last thing I did, I made an EP. I didn't make physical copies of it.
Oh, yeah?
At all. And we put it out in, like, June.
So it was just...
Why? Because an EP isn't going to make money anyway in a world, because you're paying as much as you do for something that costs $11.99, but you're only getting $4 for it or whatever.
Right.
So, and then the other thing was just kind of like, do people really... Because I buy a lot of my music naked at 3 o'clock in the morning on my computer. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. I don't buy a whole lot of physical CDs anymore.
Yeah. And as far as studios go, how are you going to record this record? You haven't started recording it yet, have you?
No. We're going up next week to start.
Okay.
And
you're going to a studio.
To a studio.
A big studio?
I don't know. That's a detail. I don't know. Yeah. When I get there, I'll get the directions.
Okay.
But no, I don't know.
Right.
But a genuine studio.
A genuine studio with real people.
Yeah.
Probably somebody, receptionist or something.
I don't know.
Not like at my studio.
No, it might be this guy's studio. Brad Jones is going to produce. He did Hayes Carl's last record.
Okay.
And he's done some of Chuck's records. And he might have a studio.
Hayes Carl's last record did really well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds good.
Yeah. He's good. Do you know him?
A little bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
We've done some gigs together.
Yeah. Do you hang out with a lot of, would you say it? But, I mean, as we get older, we've gone from being like the kids, you know, to mm-hmm. being like the whatever we are now.
The not kids
anymore. How involved are you in the scene? Or like, do you hang out with Hayes? You go like get coffee with him, and you guys talk like.
No, I don't. He come to you for wisdom. Like, I just see people when we're on gigs together.
Okay.
Basically, because really, if I'm home, I'm with the kids, because I have too much guilt to go out if I've already been out 3 nights.
Right.
With, you know, I always feel like nighttime is an important part in a kid's life, and like the whole getting in bed and stuff, and so. I don't want to be gone for that all the time. I'm already gone half the time.
Yeah.
So I don't get out at night anyway. And then in the daytime, I'm usually doing really boring things for the kids, grocery shopping or laundry it never ends.
Never ends.
Never ends.
No. Well, I don't, have we covered everything? Did you have any agenda when you came here? Is there anything you wanted
to
say? Is there anything you wanted to get out there? Do you have a point of view you need to express? You know, Occupy Kelly Willis, any kind of like anti-establishment message? I do find your tweets sometimes are so smart-assed that it made me it gave me a new level of like respect for you.
Really?
Yeah,
thanks.
And I started following you. Yeah.
Awesome. Thanks.
Yeah, and then I followed Chuck. I wish Bruce wrote.
Would tweet?
On Twitter,
yeah, he doesn't do that.
He doesn't need to, probably.
He's different.
Have you made any friends through Twitter, Liza?
Well, I met Kathy Valentine through Twitter.
Yeah.
Lots of.
That's
I've
cool.
made some friends through Twitter.
She apparently became friends with Billy Corgan from Smashing Pumpkins through Twitter.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
She wrote something and he just wrote her back. I write like idols, people I look up to on Twitter are on there one night I was pretty drunk and I was sitting in my hotel room bored. It was really late and I looked on Twitter and Nile Rodgers had written something and I'm a huge Chic fan, a huge Nile Rodgers fan. Mm-hmm. So I just wrote him. It's just, you know, I love you, dude. You're so awesome. I'm sorry you have cancer. You changed my life with your music and I love you so much. And he wrote me back. And so now, and then I tried to, you know, tried to establish some sort of friendship with him. So creepy. But have you done that? Have you ever done that? Like, you know, not stalk someone, but like, hey.
Well, yeah.
Hey, Kathy Valentine.
I did it with Kathy. I asked her about, you know, what she was, spray tan she was using on her legs. and with Roseanne Cash, I reached out to her to tell her how much I loved her.
And she wrote you back?
And she did.
She wrote me back.
She writes everybody
too.
Back, yeah. I think. That's kind of impressive. Yeah.
That's exciting.
I think that's about it, really.
Okay.
Those two people.
Well, tell Bruce I said hi.
I will. He said to tell you hi, too.
Oh, good. Yeah. That's nice. I was honest when I said he was like one of the first people that was nice to me in Austin.
I'm so proud of him for
that. Yeah. He was always just very genuine and interested. And then I remember he ran sound at Continental Club and I would sometimes go up there and kind of like hang out.
Yeah.
When he was doing that. So.
Me too. Back when we first started dating, that's where he was working the door.
Yeah.
And there was nobody ever there except when June Brown played.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's good days.
So anything you want to promote before you go? You guys have a holiday show at the Paramount.
Oh yeah,
every year. That'll be coming up.
That's coming up sometime in December.
Yeah,
but
look out, look for her at the grocery stores.
That's right.
How are your allergies?
They're better.
Good.
But I do take my Claritin regularly.
Good. Good. I should. Well, Kelly Willis, thank you so much for coming by.
Thanks for asking me.
And I'm glad that we got to talk and meet. And now I'll probably never see you again because of your social phobia and lack of going out.
I'll see you on Twitter.
Yeah, I'll see you on Twitter. All right. Bye.
Bye.
Is to spend some time with you so I can hold you. Sister says that I'm no good.
There you go. Beautiful harmony singing by her husband, Bruce Robeson. Not Bruce Willis, as thought by Jesse at the beginning of the podcast. She is adorable. That was a really good time. I liked talking to her, to Kelly, and hopefully she had a good time. I love her music, and I look forward to that album that she and Bruce are making. I wonder if people let me come and hang out at their recording sessions now, and I'll just kind of be like this weird, like the next generation of Beatle Bob, you know? Thanks for listening to my podcast. I hope someone won those books from Bruce Mahart, not Willis or Robeson. And thank you so much for listening to them. I have some more music from Kelly Willis. Enjoy it. Talk to you soon.
I'm a man in the rain. Here they come now, teddy boys. I'm a bad man all alone. I belong here, teddy boys. Oh, maybe I'm just looking.
be fun. Here they come.